Good morning. It's very good to be here on this beautiful day we have, and good to be here with all of you to be able to sing and pray and study together. Just a brief disclaimer. The groups of people I'm used to talking to are 14 and 15-year-olds that want nothing to do with learning high school math, so oftentimes I will look out at the crowd and nod very condescendingly and say, okay, does that make sense? So if I do that, don't let that bother you. It's probably just habit at this point. That being said, I don't often get the opportunity to preach in this capacity or to bring a lesson like this. I've been here two times before this to teach class, and I greatly appreciate those opportunities because it just makes me really focus in and study, and it's I oftentimes neglect that aspect of my faith, and this allows me to better equip myself in that setting. So this morning, I'll give you some brief background information before I begin. In normal, Mason Venuso is our preacher over there, and he's done a very good job of sticking to a centralized theme ever since he arrived in that location. And it's the idea of king and kingdom. And he sets it up very nicely in the way he presents his thoughts. And it always seems to circle back to that idea of king and kingdom. And it's been the driving force of many of the themes and topical discussions that Mason has been bringing to our group there in Normal. And during COVID, we were on Zoom for a while, and we decided as a group we were going to shift gears a little bit and focus our teaching and our classes for a broader audience. And if you're familiar with the idea of the Big Beautiful Story, I think it's a lesson book material that was put together. That's what we used, and Mason taught that class. And that idea was made even more prevalent to me in that setting, the idea of king and kingdom. And of course, that isn't, you know, something that the elders of our group or Mason came up with on their own. It's always been present, but it was very focused in through that lens. And the summer series we also do in Normal, if you're familiar with that, every Wednesday for a few months, we have guest speakers come from surrounding congregations and provide a talk on a central theme. And this past summer was Lessons from the Life of David. And that theme was even more hammered home then, the idea of the king and the kingdom and the foreshadowing and the parallelism that is present in the life of David. And the summer series did a great job of broadening that scope. And I heard so many great things last summer about the life of David that really stuck with me, and it made me realize an even bigger pattern that has been there all along. And again, I'm not naive enough to think that no one else has seen this pattern, or that I'm revealing to you some great truth. But really, I just hope that you can see my enthusiasm on this subject and how it began and the pattern sort of leaping off the pages to me. And if you haven't noticed this, then I hope it sticks with you after I leave this morning. So perhaps through laying out my line of thinking and the realizations I made might shed some light on some questions you have or are studying currently, and I would greatly appreciate any feedback or discussion afterwards. If you're not familiar with the phrase typology, I kind of get used to shutting my ears when I hear that word. I was not a big fan of studying typology in any setting. It was too scholarly for me, I would say. And if you don't know what it means, that's okay, because I didn't, and I don't know if I sure do anymore. It seems to change oftentimes, but the main idea is types of Christ. And throughout the Bible, we see types of Christ. We see it in Moses, Abraham, David. And the emphasis, however, should be noted that none of these are perfect illustrations of Christ. And I think that's the benefit to studying typology, if you can approach it that way, noticing that we have these patterns, but ultimately recognizing the faults and flaws in the types that present themselves. So I have began to enjoy a little more when others point out some typology to me. It's just It's another affirmation of the pattern that's in place. I'm trying to have a better attitude when someone presents something of that vein to me. And it just, again, it illustrates a beautiful architecture and a design throughout the Bible and in God's big, beautiful story. And this summer series we recently had on the life of David, I don't know if I was paying attention more or I was just trying to make it more personal to myself, but it just seemed to be leaping off the pages to me. Dominic Venuso, Mason's brother, and some of you may be familiar with him, he gave a lesson on what we just read, the scripture reading we just had. And that was always a passage to me that was easy to tune out because there's a lot of funny sounding names and a lot of background information that seems to be unimportant. But this time, the way Dominic presented it really made sense to me. I had never thought of it this way. So if you recall in the scripture reading we just had, to spare some of the details, David has recently had disaster strike after he attempts to have a census of his people. And he kind of takes the prideful route, and God reprimands him for that, and there is now a plague upon Israel. And David is seeking to undo that curse on his people. So he goes out, and he finds a threshing floor owned by a man, and he asks, give me this spot so that I can build an altar to the Lord. Give me this spot that I can build an altar to the Lord. I will buy it from you. And the man, knowing that it's King David and that this is what he should do, says, just take it. It's yours. It's free. And the words that really stuck out with me is what David said in verse 24 of 1 Chronicles 21, verse 24. But King David said to Ornan, no, but I will buy them from you for the full price. I will not take for the Lord what is yours, nor offer burnt offering that cost me nothing. And that idea that David wasn't willing to offer sacrifice on something that cost him nothing is really what spurred the thoughts I have this morning. I started to realize a pattern that had been missing all along. If you weren't aware, this threshing floor that David insists on purchasing ends up being the site that the temple would be built on in years to come when Solomon decides to build the temple. I never really knew that. I knew David had wanted to build a temple, and God had told him no. And I know that was upsetting to David. And I never knew that this threshing floor that David purchased, that he insisted on buying, would end up being the site of something so significant. And those words, this has to cost me something, I began to realize this sort of pattern throughout Scripture. So, the idea of what I want to talk about this morning is the idea of temple progression. I want to look at specific instances in Scripture where we progress from one version of a temple to another. And when I say temple, I really am just implying the idea of God dwelling with His people in some capacity. We see how that shifts throughout Scripture, throughout the stories of the Old Testament and in the New Testament. God dwelling with His people takes on a different shape. And typically, there was someone or something involved when that took place. So I want to look at what specific events and people were involved when that new version of the temple sprang into existence. What was done to ensure that this version of the temple came about? So, I realize this is out of order because I want to try to stick to kind of a flow of temple progression, but I'm going to refer back to what I was just talking about with Dominic's lesson he gave on David and the threshing floor. Just to kind of show you what I'm going for here. So what Dominic did was break down the thoughts and emotions that were going into David's decisions about his census he had just had disaster with, how those decisions negatively affected those around him. And then he connected that to the final story we just talked about with David purchasing the threshing floor. And again, to me, there's so much significance in David being the one who purchases that threshing floor. Because I believe that's sort of the moment that produces the temple. Again, David wasn't the one that built the temple. And if we look back at when David first desired to build that temple, God denied him. Really quickly, I'll read 1 Chronicles chapter 22, verses 6 through 10. 1 Chronicles 22, verses 6 through 10. Then he called for Solomon his son and charged him to build a house for the Lord, the God of Israel. David said to Solomon, "My son, I had it in my heart to build a house to the name of the Lord my God. But the word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'You have shed much blood and have waged great wars. You shall not build a house to my name, because you have shed so much blood before me on the earth. Behold, a son shall be born to you who shall be a man of rest. I will give him rest from all of his surrounding enemies, for his name shall be Solomon. And I will give peace and quiet to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, he shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish his royal throne in Israel forever.'" So, a lot more goes into those statements that we aren't going to focus on this morning. But what Dominic did was he connected this idea of David and the temple to David's life. And for the sake of time, I won't read again the scripture we had this morning, but if you remember what David said at the end of that section, he says, "I won't build this if it costs me nothing. I cannot sacrifice if it costs me nothing." He insists on paying for the threshing floor, even though he could have taken it for free. And what Dominic highlighted then was the significance of this coming right after the census. David's attitude towards the census, and again, that was just really, God instructed him to do this. The story is confusing. God says, "Take a census of the people." And at first glance, it looks like David really didn't do anything wrong. But David takes this census, and his attitude towards the census became more about his own fame than for the glory of God. He got away from the original purpose. And David came to the conclusion after God started to unleash this plague on Israel. David came to the conclusion that in order for a sacrifice to be worthy, it must cost something. And that's really the whole idea of sacrifice. For David to be a worthy sacrifice or a blessing, it must cost him something. And at the time of Dominic's lesson, this all started to come to me, and Henry even said something about last night, the rantings of a madman. That's kind of what my notes looked like. I was furiously writing down these thoughts coming to me during Dominic's lesson, and then at the end I was trying to pull them all together. I sympathize with that, but I wrote down this one phrase over and over: sacrificial blessing. Sacrificial blessing. And it's kind of an interesting phrase. I don't know if I've really heard anyone use it before. But that's what David was doing. He was trying to bless his people by being sacrificial. And if we look at the moment that David purchased that threshing floor to build the altar as a moment of temple progression, then we see what was necessary to achieve that moment in time. Someone had to step up and be that blessing. In order for God to begin to dwell with his people in a new capacity, David had to step up and be that sacrificial blessing. So now with the rest of our time, I'd like to try to highlight some of the important people working in conjunction with God's power, and that those people achieve that temple progression by being a sacrificial blessing. I'm hoping we can start to see this pattern a little more easily throughout Scripture as we go forward and make more connections that I might overlook here, so I would encourage you to study further. So, the way I had set this up in normal, I have done this lesson before, but I drew a little diagram, and I had a whiteboard there, and I was a little bit negligent and didn't prepare a PowerPoint, but I sort of put this cycle. It started with the garden, and then with the tabernacle, and then with the temple, the New Testament temple, and then back to the garden. It was like this cycle that all started with the garden and ended with the garden. And the cycle looks like it would go around and around, but that's not really the point. So I'm going to not start with the garden. I'm not going to go with the cycle. I'm going to come back to the garden, but really that's the first time we see God dwelling with his people. That's the first version of a temple that really stood out to me. And so after the garden, the tabernacle was the next sort of formal temple that God chose to use with his people. And keeping in mind, just because there's not a formal structure in place, a physical building, that doesn't mean God isn't dwelling with his people. I believe temples were really just a physical illustration of God dwelling with his people. And we see that each temple gets better and better as we progress through Scripture. If we think of the one person associated with old law, and especially the tabernacle, I think of Moses. Moses was the guy when it came to this sort of stuff. And there might be a little bit of a differing opinion on the timeline I construct with this tabernacle, but to me there's one specific instance with Moses that I would like to point out that achieved this temple progression. Something that always stood out to me about the tabernacle was, if you remember the story, when Moses would enter, the pillar of cloud or the pillar of fire would be hovering over the tabernacle and it would fill the tabernacle with God's presence. I'm going to read the last five verses of Exodus chapter 40. Exodus chapter 40, the last five verses. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on it. And the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the people of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they did not set out till the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, and fire was in it by night, and in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. So if I'm an Israelite, I get a bit of a weird feeling in my stomach every time I see that cloud or that pillar of fire. That would kind of spook me out a little bit, I think. I think it'd be one of the most striking things about being an Israelite in that time. That physical presence of God, it was a constant reminder to the Israelites that he was with them. Imagine if they woke up one day and that pillar of cloud or fire was gone after it had been with them for so long. How do you think that would have made them feel? To them, the pillar of cloud and fire was their security, and the tabernacle, it wouldn't mean much if they didn't know that God's presence was in it. They began to associate that tabernacle with God's presence, and really with the pillar of cloud and fire. So I say all of this to get us back to the main point. When was the first time the Israelites saw that pillar of cloud? Well, if we look back, it was right at the beginning of their journey out of Egypt. It was their leader through the wilderness. Let's read Exodus 13, verses 17 through chapter 14, verse 20. It's a bit of a lengthier reading, but I really wanted to illustrate my point here. Exodus 13, 17, starting in verse 17. When Pharaoh let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. And the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here. And they moved on from Succoth and encamped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea. In front of Baal Zephon you shall encamp facing it by the sea. For if Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land, the wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, and they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. And they said, what is this that we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them. All Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army and overtook him and overtook them and encamped at the sea by Pi-Hahiroth and in front of Baal Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they feared greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, and this is where I want us to focus in here. A lot of details there that can kind of glaze over your eyes, but this is the crux of what I wanted to get here. They said to Moses, "Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you only have to be silent." The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward, lift up your staff, and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen." Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was a cloud in the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. I just love the imagery that story I read just gave us. Again, this being the first time the Israelites really see that pillar of cloud leading them out of Egypt. Imagine what a striking scene that is when it moves from before you to behind you, between you and the Egyptians. So back to the main question, how did Moses play a significant role right in this moment to achieve this temple progression? Prior to this, Moses had obviously been in the forefront of the battle against Pharaoh to release Israel. However, if you recall, he was very reluctant to show that he was willing to take a stand and be the leader. To me, there's a different version of Moses that we see here. As he physically leads Israel out of the wilderness, he stepped up in a way that maybe he hadn't committed to before. He took on the role of Israel's leader, and they saw him as that without a doubt. In that moment, when he stands up and says, "See the glory of the Lord," and that pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire move behind them, between them and the Egyptians, he became that sacrificial blessing that Israel needed to get to that next temple progression. So hopefully the way I laid that out makes sense, but in a nutshell, Moses was a sacrificial blessing in the moment that the Israelites saw the physical dwelling of God with them begin. So in our next temple progression, so we started with the garden, we're now at the tabernacle. This next temple progression is the one I've already talked about. It's David's when he steps up to be the sacrificial blessing as he bought the threshing floor for an arguably obscene price to build the altar that ultimately led to the temple that everyone thinks about taking place, right? You think of the word temple, you think of that Solomon's temple. I could really talk about that story for hours of David buying the threshing floor. Unfortunately, we don't have the time for that, and I don't think you would want that either. But I think just based off of some of the jumbled thoughts I had written down, looking back, if you think about what that represented, looking back, it's just so significant when he decides he wants to buy that threshing floor. And the details of the story are, I don't know if the numbers bear this out, this is what I've heard though, the price he ends up paying for that threshing floor is way more than it's worth. David decides, I'm going to pay for this and I'm going to pay a lot for it. This needs to cost me something. Because David had great wealth. If he had just given him $5 to say there was a transaction made, that wouldn't cost David anything. So I've hammered that enough, I think, that story. So I'll go ahead and get to the next version of the temple that is extremely important to us. So we started at the garden. We went to the tabernacle. We went to David's and Solomon's time. And now I'm going to go to what we have now. This version of the temple we have now. So we're really drawing to a close here. And I don't feel a huge need to lay things out again like I did with the other three versions of the temple. But plain and simple, Jesus was the sacrificial blessing that led us to the version of temple that we are in now. In the diagram I drew, in normal on the whiteboard, I drew a picture of a garden, a tabernacle, a temple, and then for this version of the temple we're in now, I drew a torn temple veil. It was very rudimentary. It wasn't anything too artistic, but hopefully the illustration was effective. And the story of the crucifixion and when the temple veil is torn in two, to me that illustrates so much the need to understand the old law in conjunction with the gospel. I was horrible at this when I was younger. I would sit through classes on Leviticus and I could not take it. I didn't enjoy it. I didn't understand the need for it. It wasn't applicable to us now. However, if I didn't understand what that temple veil meant in the temple, knowing that it's what separated the holy place from the most holy place, this wouldn't have any significance for us when that temple veil was torn in two. So imagine reading Matthew 27, verse 51, without that understanding of what the temple veil meant. Behold, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth shook and the rocks were split. So that's talking about the moment of Jesus' death. If you didn't know what that temple veil represented, and if you're still unsure, I would encourage you to ask. Ask someone about this afterwards. Study it. When that temple veil was torn in two, it changed everything. It got us to that next temple progression that we're in today. So at the moment, we progress to such a powerful role in the way that God would dwell with His people. Jesus was the sacrificial blessing in that moment in time. And He got us to that version. And so now this bears even more weight as we consider where we go from here. Because this isn't it. This isn't the last temple we're going to be in. This is not the final version of the temple we should be looking forward to. And if you notice the way I've laid things out, it's again, it started with the garden, the tabernacle, the temple, to where we are now. Logically, you would think it goes back to the garden and just keeps going. It doesn't. It goes back to the garden, but we stop there, hopefully. The garden represented pure, unadulterated reliance in dwelling with God, until it wasn't. But we're striving for that. The point of this lesson is to illustrate that. That is why the version of the temple we are in now means so much. Because we now must become the sacrificial blessing to achieve that ultimate and final version of the temple. Not only for ourselves, but for everyone around us as well. When we share the good news with others, it's a sacrifice. It's hard. But ultimately, that is what makes us a blessing to those around us and in our community. I truly think that the times where we see the disarray that the people of Israel are in is undone when someone steps up and others to become the sacrificial blessing that God requires to bring His people out of the chaos and out of the disorder that they are in. I acknowledge that the four I used this morning, they're not the only times this occurs. They're not the only people that stood up as sacrificial blessings. If you think of Abraham, Joseph, Zerubbabel, so many of these characters in the Bible, when Israel's drawn away, when everything seems to stall out in the time of the kings, we see kings not doing the job they're supposed to, that David did. It just fluctuates back and forth. Someone steps up. God dwells with His people again. People aren't doing what they're supposed to do. Israel falls away. Someone steps up. It fluctuates until we get to Jesus becoming the ultimate sacrifice that gets us out of that rut. And so now it's our turn. And the thing is, we don't know when that next step will take place. We don't know when that next temple progression is going to start. And most people probably didn't know it was going to happen to them either. I mean, look at how Moses responded to God's call. He wasn't expecting it. He was content to live out his days as a shepherd in Midian. But that trumpet call of resurrection is going to be that final call to the final and the best temple that is dwelling with God. That pure, unadulterated reliance in dwelling with God that the garden represented. The book of Hebrews really does a much better job of saying everything I've said this morning. In the context of the whole book being about something better, I pulled out one verse, Hebrews 10, verse 14. For by a single offering he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. For by a single offering, meaning Jesus, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. This is what the sacrifice of Jesus and that temple progression did for us. It's what it's doing for us. We now have the opportunity to become those living sacrifices that Paul talks about in Romans. That's how we get there. I'll take this opportunity to share a little bit. Recently with myself, I've come to a bit of a crossroads. The past year and a half of my life has been very, very different. I've started a new job. I've bought a house. I just have a lot more responsibility in life. And looking around at me, it became easier and easier and easier to shirk the responsibilities I had as a Christian that I was told to do. It was easier for me to sit back on my hands and let others do the work. It was easier for me to neglect meeting with the saints. It was easier for me to sort of sit in the background and hope that it comes to me, to hope that this next temple comes to me. And what got me out of this rut, what's kind of got things going, was one, coming to understand what I presented to you this morning, but two, this song, "When My Love to Christ Grows Weak." I had never understood the words the way it made sense to me now. And I'm not going to read all of it, but just a bit of it. "There behold his agony, suffered on the bitter tree. See his anguish, see his faith. Love triumphant still in death. Then to life I turn again, learning all the worth of pain, learning all the might that lies in a full self-sacrifice. When my love to Christ grew weak, and I didn't know how to get back, I turned to life again. I learned the worth of pain. I learned all the might that lies in a full self-sacrifice. And I'm not there yet. I haven't quite done it yet. But I know I can't sit back on my hands and wait for it to come to me." That song has such beautiful imagery that really highlights my thoughts very well. So I hope we can come to realize the might that lies in a full self-sacrifice, because the world needs it. People need to step up in a time when so many are afraid and not willing to do so or wanting to do so. And so if we look at what the significance of this day represents to so many people and what that sacrifice did for us to achieve that temple version that we're in now, where we can dwell with God and rely on Him, it's still just not quite it yet. We still have another temple to seek out. Jesus got us to the one we're in now. Now we have to step up. We have to be the sacrificial blessing to achieve that next temple. So that's my encouragement to you this morning. Let's progress to that next temple together and bring as many with us as we can along the way.